7. Castellans. Chapter 15. The skies were once slate grey, made choppy by winds from the Keldar Sea and piled with cloud. The rains would be hard and cold, angled steeply, and dashed against the dark rocks of a treacherous shore. Birds would wheel in those storms, thrown wildly. Men and women would look up and see the elemental fury of their home and take quiet satisfaction. "This is a violent world," they would say, "so much the better for breeding the strong." Now the skies have no storms. The grey is gone, replaced by a dull red that strains the eyes and makes the heart beat too fast. The birds do not fly, but crouch, bewildered, in their high eyries. The waves beat thickly against the rocks, but no spray flies. All is sluggish now, dark in the lee, glimmering like old oil. Zirias no longer looks to the coast for inspiration. For years he made his meditations high above the north-facing Delos Gate, feeling the ice-sharp wind against his face. He would watch the physical storm and reflect on the metaphysical storm. None would disturb him in those times, not even a fellow battle brother. For just a few minutes, immediately before dawn, he was alone with the elements. When the first of the world's suns rose, sending a long line of silver spreading across the broken horizon, making the wavetops glint like spear tips, he would close his eyes. "As Ultramar, so the galaxy," he would say, recounting the last words uttered, reportedly, from the lips of the Primarch himself to the first chapter master, before leaving distant Macragge. It had always been an ambitious goal, so far from the heart of power. The precise reasons for the exodus were long lost to the vagaries of time, though the intent was never doubted. Close to 10,000 years of service, unbroken, defiant, set right up against the borders of reality. Ultramar would never be remade here, on the fringes of the eye itself, but a fraction of its resolve persisted, lodged deep. Worlds were raised and kept guarded, populations made orderly. The law came to the Sabbatine subsector and was nourished, putting down roots. Now Zidius only sees the end of that long story. In his darkest moments, he thinks of the line of chapter masters engraved on the basalt of the Hall of Honor, flickering by the light of oil taper candles. He thinks of his own name, Saimar Zidias, the very last. He thinks on the artisans who have chiseled those names, one after the other, centuries apart, but linked by that single thread of history. Mostly, defiance remains. He plans, he makes provision. He ensures that all around him is set right, and that the walls are still guarded. He does not allow doubt to enter his disciplined mind, certainly not despair. He remains, as he has ever been, efficient and active. But his name has no successors. It remains there, near the base of a single slab of stone, with empty space for more. That empty space is a rebuke. If he allowed it to, it would haunt him. Zidius strides along the corridor leading from the Gyges Gate towards the inner keep. Dawn is still an hour away, and only the weakest red light bleeds through the narrow windows. It is bitterly cold, though his armor shields him from the worst. He has been armored, without respite, for months now. All of the remaining garrison have been, by his orders. He is weary to his core. His hands, locked away in those heavy gauntlets, hang by his side. To remain on his feet, to remain awake and alert, these are challenges now. Perhaps the loss of the Astronomicon is part of this. Perhaps they never truly realized just how profound the link was with the beacon, invisible to all but the psychers and the navigators, but somehow sensed. Its removal has done more than cripple shipping and supply routes. It has removed something essential and intangible, the great link to the throne world that they all, even the space marines, needed to feel. He must believe, in the absence of any proof, that Terra is still unconquered. He must believe that somewhere resistance is being mustered. He reaches the end of the corridor, where the doors stand open. Two guards bow low as he approaches. Chapter serfs in grey carapace armour and blue tabards. They make a decent show of looking alert, and their gear is in good condition, but Zidius can see the fatigue in their eyes. He pauses before crossing the threshold. He looks at them both. 19th Company, he says, observing the designations on their breasts and nodding. Rotated back from the Orvian exterior line. Well done. Well fought. They mumble thanks. The Emperor protects, Zidius says.
In eternal faith,
they both reply, making the Aquila. Then he moves on. He would like to spend more time with them, find out more from their own mouths about what they have seen out there, offer words of encouragement that might move beyond platitudes. But there is already so little time, and so many others who deserve his attention. The Praetorian squads have been well-trained and well-equipped. He must remember to trust what has been done here over the centuries to make these people strong. He enters a round chamber with slit windows set into the wall at regular intervals. The roof is domed and carries a fresco of the Primarch meeting the Emperor on Macrag. A long crack snakes from floor level to the apex, still unrepaired from the bombardment 3 weeks back. The floor is a dark, polished marble, and around the chamber rim sit columns with assorted battle honours set within shimmering force fields. A helm, a gladius, the tattered remnants of an old war standard. Atramo is there, in his deep blue librarian plate, the tallest and broadest of those assembled, save Zidius himself. Opposite him is Memnon, 4th company captain, and the most senior of his surviving officers. Next in the semicircle is Tadakar, Praetorian Castellan commander, then cowled Diomada, mistress of Astropaths. Memnon's chaplain, Candred, has returned from fighting on the Bulwark Ridge, and his armor is stained dirt red. The acting master of the fleet, Landian, completes the makeshift command group, and is the most pitiable of all. He has no fleet left to command, just a couple of half-functional monitors at high anchor over the monastery's spires, and what remains of the chapter's atmospheric flyers.
My brothers,
Zidius says, directing a perfunctory bow towards the Space Marines, then a brief acknowledgement of the two baseline humans.
I will ask you, mistress, the same thing I ask at every dawn.
Diomada smiles thinly, her eyeless face gaunt under a heavy cowl.
And I shall give you the same answer, Lord. Nothing but screams.
Atramo grunts in agreement. He was a sour fellow even before this began.
I begin to think this is no fleeting effect. I begin to think this is the way of things now.
He has been hit hardest of all by the change. The path of the librarian has always been strenuous, a test for the mind and the soul as much as the body. But now things are excruciating. Zidius has heard the cries of anguish from Atramo's cell in the deep of the night, and has had to order him to refrain from probing beyond the veil, unless in combat. As Diomada says, it is nothing but screams now.
The rules are broken,
Atramo had told him, months ago now, when it all changed.
Everything I learned, studied, all gone.
That much became obvious soon enough. There can be no pretense about the demonic anymore, for they are seen in every street and over every cathedral, translucent and fighting hard for instantiation. When they make it, ripping themselves through folds in the air and the earth, the killing is unrestrained.
And if this is eternal, we adjust to it, says Memnon sharply.
Those two are wearing at one another like ill-aligned wheels in a machine. Zidius instinctively sympathizes with his captain. Speculation is of no use, and the best must be made of things. But he feels his weakness acutely. The chapter has been taking damage for a long time. First, there was the disaster of the Boros Gate, the catastrophe that destroyed close to 5 whole companies, half the chapter's total. He had not been there, but had ceded operational command, as was the custom, to his counterpart, Chapter Master Titus Valens. Valens died in that bloodbath, replaced by his nominated successor, Rydian Artemenis. When the call for Cadia came, it was also Artemenis's place to answer. This was the way of the White Consuls, a chapter master to oversee the wars, a chapter master to keep the walls. Such a dual arrangement had many strengths, and it had enabled rapid recovery after Boros. As a result, the chapter was able to field 10 companies for the Grand Muster at Cadia, albeit at various levels of readiness for combat, and with the numerically weakest, the fourth, leaving much of its complement on Sabatine as a skeleton guard force. Zidius had come close to overriding precedent and demanding to lead the Cadian offensive. Artemenes was in most respects his junior, despite the formal equality of rank, and would surely not have resisted a direct injunction. The burning shame of Boros had played on Zidius's mind for years, and to lead the chapter into that greater battle would have been a way of making restitution. But the power of the law, in the end, was too great. Everything they had built on Sabatine had revolved around the law, both its spirit and its letter. To deny that now, when everything was racing towards oblivion with such terrifying speed, would have been a renunciation of it all. So he had stayed. He had watched almost the entire chapter's total strength make for the void. He had seen the fleet leave, its thrusters glowing white-blue on the run towards the Mandeville points. No one had been in any doubt that the situation at Cadia was critical, and so the bare minimum guard remained in the Sabatine's great monastery, 80 battle brothers, 30 of whom had been accelerated from service in the scouts, and 12 who were still in recovery from near-terminal wounds in other battles. Two Castraferum dreadnoughts, Brother Argan and Brother Jeremias. 3 regiments of Sabatine Praetorians, totaling just under 7,000 troops, only a fifth of that sent with the fleet to Cadia. Auxiliary serfs, militia and standing urban defence forces, plus a token orbital presence. It had been a great risk. In normal times, such near-complete off-world deployment would never have been undertaken, but all knew the cost should Cadia fall. As a chapter of the Astartes Praeses, it was the White Consul's most solemn duty to ensure that the guard on the Eye of Terror was maintained at all times. Most solemn duty. Zidius feels the accusation in those 3 words, and they bear down on him now like a physical burden. In the past, his chapter guarded an entire realm of far-flung worlds, sending guardians to administer and oversee them. Now, they cannot even master their own failing citadel.
"Report, if you please, Castellan Commander," he says.
Tadakar clears his throat.
"Controlled withdrawal from Kaldama and Bastion Tor continues according to schedule. Losses within anticipated parameters, and the garrison at Hartad evacuated almost intact. Last elements of the guard on Orvian are now beyond contact. The 15th armoured assumed lost. No reports from south of the 45th parallel. All zones there also assumed overrun. Acceptable control maintained across the 3 cities, though reports of incursion increase. Commissars have been stationed at all main gates as ordered."
It is a grim tally. Sabatine is an administrative centre, a world studded with dense settlement and straggling urban hinterlands. For millennia, it has been as well-ordered and as peaceful as any imperial world could be, but the sudden surge of cult activity, fueled by the psychological shock of the Astronomicon failing, has proved impossible to contain. Once, demons were just rumours to these people, clamped down on by the priests and the inquisitors. Now all can witness them capering bloodily from spire to spire, grinning through their slaughter, and it has turned the minds of an entire planet. The rules are broken.
"In my judgment, the time has come," Zidius says. "We have responsibilities to this world, but when we can no longer exert control, we must guard our own. The fortress is too vulnerable."
Atramo nods, but Candred resists.
"We can hold the 3 cities," he urges. "The Imperial cult retains its strongest hold there. Just 3 squads would suffice to keep a lid on disorder."
"Just 3 squads," says Zidius, amused. "From which duties would you pull them, Candred?"
"As you said, Lord," Candred says, "we have responsibilities."
That is correct, and the reminder makes him wince. The White Consuls have always taken that seriously, nurturing the potential of the millions placed under their watch. Already, many citizens have been evacuated inside the monastery's high walls. Senior administrators, military staff, astropaths and priests. But capacity is limited, and now the halls are bursting.
"Your devotion to them is commendable, brother,"
Atramo says. But we cannot disperse our strength any longer. The fortress must be fully guarded.
You have seen what they're doing to our people out there?
Candred asks, a vein of anger in his controlled voice.
I have seen it all, says Atramo, more even than you.
Zidius is privy to counsel from Atramo that none other hears, and so the words ring both true and chill. Atramo says the warp is now spilling like floodwater over the entirety of the galaxy, drenching the void with its contamination. He says that the stars themselves are in pain, and that the laws of physics are being strained beyond tolerance. No ships cross those treacherous gulfs without taking catastrophic damage, and even the navigators cannot peer into that morass without losing their minds. No help will come from the void, Atramo says, for the only ones who traverse it now are already damned.
I understand the argument, says Memnon, as ever in lockstep with his chaplain, but the tactical squads can be recalled at a moment's notice. Better to keep them fighting than patrol the walls in idleness.
It will not be idleness for long, Atramo says.
That is the truth,
says Diomada, who also experiences the horror more completely than most.
Forgive me if this is speaking beyond my station, but you have already done more than duty demands. They are coming now. We all know it. Some of us feel it. And survival is the first duty of us all.
The regiments can fight for a few more days,
Tadakar says. At first, Zidius thinks this is designed to put pressure on his decision, but then realizes what he means. They will sacrifice themselves to guard the withdrawal, just as they have been trained to do. That is yet another spike at his soul.
There is no escaping it, Zidius says. If any of those we sent to Cadia still live, they are far out of range. We cannot even send our gene banks into the void. Such is the peril there. We have done what we can. Now we take to the walls.
Candred tries a final time.
They are fighting for us, Lord. They chant your name, and then they march out to die. We could march beside them if we chose, for just a little longer.
Zidius turns to him and sees his scarred face, his dark eyes, his utter commitment. There is no insurrection in those words, just belief. Candred is an exemplary chaplain, fueled by the fire of faith. For a moment, staring into that furnace, Zidius feels his own resolve tested. It has been too long since he took to the outer battlefield himself. But then the combead at his neck pulses, a priority burst from Gamond, the master of signals. He silently shunts it to his earpiece.
Apologies, Lord, comes Gamond's crackling voice. Two inbound markers detected. Hostile, battlecruiser class. Arrival within 6 hours. Orbital protocols, what remains of them, enacted.
Zidius smiles darkly. At least there are no more choices now.
Argument noted, my brother, he says to Candred, thinking of the slab of names and its empty terminus. But we pull back to the walls. The fortress must stand, if all else is lost in darkness.
He feels the first stirrings of hyperadrenaline, an automatic response triggered by the very thought of battle.
This is a violent world, he thinks. So much the better for breeding the strong.
Vigilia Carceris, the guarded peak, stands alone. The nearest conurbations are several hundred kilometers away, spread out across the fertile lowlands of the Mandua Depression. To the east of the urban zone, the land rises sharply, a folded country of glistening black rock. The only tracks through that hard country are narrow and impassable, except for the mechanized transports of the Chapter and the Praetorians. Eventually, the highlands surge further up into steep-flanked mountains, barred by grey snow and hounded by the salt-thick winds, until that ever-rising country meets the grey press of the wild ocean and drops again precipitously. At the land's extreme extent, the Oron Peninsula thrusts out far into the Keldar Sea, a spar of cliffs and jumbled peaks that soars hundreds of meters above the churning swell. Its sides are as sheer as spear shafts, striated with lines of ice and needled rock pinnacles. The air is thin across that high mass, and no trees grow across the slick, wet stone. This is the landscape used to prove the mettle of aspirants. They are tested against the chill, the weather violence, the driving wind. When the storms break across the cliffs, boiling up out of the endless grey ocean to smash into that spur of stone, it is as if the gods are hurling their fists at it in anger. The easternmost tip of the Aurorn would be a formidable defensive bastion, even if no citadel had ever been raised there. A high knuckle of solid bedrock, bordered on three sides by plummets to the white surf, jabbed imperiously out into the storm surge as a statement of immortal defiance. Over the millennia, though, the natural summit has been moulded and delved and hammered, eventually becoming a home fit for a chapter of the Adeptus Astartes. Its foundations were laid in the immediate aftermath of the Great Scouring, when a bruised and rebuilding Imperium still commanded the secrets of ancient manufacture. The vaults of Vigilia Carceris are cut deep into the naked rock, the walls raised high above it. Its outer curtain traces the lines of the cliffs, creating a bow wave of black adamantium that soars even higher, both proud and austere. Parapets are lined with defense lasers, inside which towers are raised, heavy-set, heavy-buttressed, overlooking one another to create close-packed fire lanes and kill zones. Jails, forges, and armories have been carved out in the dripping foundations, until the many chambers run into the hundreds, and an entire city emerges within those rock-cradled bastion walls. A fortress monastery is a gigantic thing. It houses tens of thousands, from the lowliest servitors to warriors only a step less capable than the space marines they serve. Every single battle brother of the chapter is enabled by an interlocking web of 100 attendants, all given their function to ensure that his weapons are blessed, his armor is maintained, his chambers are kept pristine, and his rites of devotion are accommodated. Cavernous hangars ring with a constant din of metalwork. Shuttle bays thrum with a ceaseless cycle of landing and launching. Immense reactors, buried deep in Sabatine's crust, provide power levels commensurate with a line battleship, driving huge void shield generators and fixed las cannon batteries. Every surface is engraved with warding sigils against corruption, and every battlement is patrolled by lethal sentinels. Great rock-crete stages stand under the spiked shadow of gunlines, the largest of which are capable of receiving regimental landers. Thunderhawks prowl like carrion crows above the high gates, arched and studded in the Gothic template so familiar across the sprawling territories of the throne. Vigilia Carceris has stood unbroken against every assault ever sent from the Eye's Edge. Aspirants from the Sabatine Protectorate worlds have been taken up inside its walls for millennia, a ceaseless supply of new blood for the chapter's never-ending wars, only to emerge again on white ships to sail the unquiet tides of the restless void. Now that movement is stilled. A few stragglers from its retreating armies race under the cover of the guns, trailing smog behind overworked turbines. Klaxons blare across the narrow courtyards, sending even the mute servitors trundling for cover. Searchlights scan and pool across the high towers, and void shields burst into gauzy hemispheres over the spire summits. The seas are no longer slate grey, but red, like a burst artery, and the crash of waves has been replaced by the echoing song of half-born demons. The western horizons are burning, marked by the battles along the perimeter of the three cities that cannot be won, for chaos has come to this world, unbound and infinite, and the tide of it now only flows one way. Soon the heavens are scored, scraped by long trails of fire. The clouds above the citadel flash wildly, lit from beyond. Comet trails sear down from the hidden heights, plunging through thunderheads to crash into distant seas. This is orbital wreckage. Sabatine's shattered defense satellites, plus the remains of the enemy vessels they took down before their destruction. In normal times, that grid would have been bolstered by hundreds of capable ships, and in their absence, the token defenses are taking a battering. It only takes a few hours before ordnance is scything through the flame-wreathed heavens, orbital lasers hurled from the undersides of great battleships, lime green and forge red. The beams smack into the hard ground and splinter from the cliff sides. Plumes of steam boil up from the shoreline, growing greater as yet more las strikes rain down. The rain becomes a deluge, a single massive column of coruscation that zips and roars, crashing over the void shields and spraying madly. Vigilia Carceris is lost behind a wall of fire, a thumping curtain that sends rock shards bouncing and foundations shaking. The fortress lets loose with its own defense lasers, and the inferno ramps up further. The air shakes with heat. The rocks begin to glow. This is the opening salvo, the softening up. While the guns of the Citadel are fully occupied, their operators' zoom sights blazing with light and their shield generators shrieking with overload, the twin battleships are emptying out somewhere up above, their hangars streaming with lines of attack ships, their drop pod bays ejecting, their launch tunnels hurling landers along the rails and swinging out into the las-crossed void. Some landers are taken out by the remaining orbital defenses, blasted apart before they can duck into re-entry. Other vessels remain in the low void layer, going after those scraps of satellites and defense platforms in a hammer rain of hard round fire. Most, though, shoot straight down planetwards, spiraling through hails of beam shards, kindling re-entry fires of their own before they smash into the upracing world. As they emerge below the cloud layer, punching like bullets out into open air, gunners on the Citadel walls unleash their first defensive volleys. Many incoming landers streak down far outside the gun's effective range, but a few foolhardy or misaimed pods stray into the kill zone and are blasted apart. The Oron Highlands are soon showered in blown ironwork, still burning from the descent, tumbling at high speed across the stone. The Citadel is now shrouded in flame, doused in a void-hurled column that spits and smashes, turning the void shields white-hot and pushing them concave. The gouts of steam grow and merge and hiss up from the seas below, rearing high above the parapets. Return fire is overwhelmed, damped down by the volume of incoming ordnance from above. This gives greater cover to the landers, which are now falling freely across the peninsula. Drop pods slam down, throwing up smashed boulder fragments on impact. The doors cantilever open, thudding hard, and troops lumber out, carrying bolters and flamers. Larger pods make planetfall next, spewing forth the striding machine mountains of hellbrutes and other stalking, roaring, half-mechanical horrors. The biggest units, crowned with brass death heads and embossed armor plate, hit the earth in clouds of thrown smoke and grit. When their great doors swing open, corrupted tanks rumble down the ramps, rocking as their studded tracks grind against the crust of a new world to slaughter. Some of these are looted Astra Militarum vehicles, their armor marked with the octet and the sign of the god, and crewed by spine-clamped, limb-locked cultists. Others are the preserve of the legions, rhino transports in crimson livery and flaming braziers, or demon-bound crawlers with hunched spines and rust-streaked dozer blades. The pace of planetfall rises exponentially. Out of range of all but the largest of the Citadel's land guns, truly massive carriers wallow down, their thruster arrays kicking out columns of sooty flame. When their hatches crack open and the embarkation ramps telescope out, whole hordes of the lost and the damned charge out into the open. They are clad in scraps and armor fragments, snatches of imperial military garb, and rags from the bilges of traitor warships. Some have no eyes, some obscenely bulging torsos. Those from the word-bearers' conveyors are cut and tattooed and marked with the ritual favor sigils of all four gods. Those from the lumpen hulls of Death Guard landers limp more slowly, dragging club feet through the smouldering dust. They grin as they advance, hoisting hook spears and stubber guns. They can't help grinning. All they do, all the time, those half-dead sloggers, is grin. The impacts keep on coming. Yet greater transports thunder earthwards, many hit hard on the descent, but able to absorb the strikes. They disgorge heavy artillery, demon engines with towers of bronze that hiss with steam, malice, and agony. The dust and flame mingle, swirling, making their outlines hazy. Eye lenses glow in the miasma, and released bloat drones wobble through the murk, lone seeker lenses already whirring, and loft turbines buzzing. The tank squadrons grind ahead, angling long barrels to aim at the battlements. The outermost walls of Vigilia Carceris are already lost in a shaking gauze of heat and kicked-up dust, but their size is still apparent, a mountain of smooth, dark adamantium, solid amid the hammering inferno. Artillery units grind into position, hauled by chain gangs and slavering mutant ogrins. Pot-bellied mortar cauldrons are stoked for their ignition spikes, lined up in long ranks. The ground is breaking up, split by the weight of treads and hooves. Flying debris joins the steam and dust, mixing into a maelstrom that clogs lenses and silts up viewfinders. It is not just the physical that suffers, for the weft between worlds has already been ripped by Abaddon's rift, and it only takes this incipient violence, this mustering of energetic hatred, to yank it aside completely. So the demons come, spilling out of fleet dropships or jerking into reality from the curdled air. Little lords bounce and wriggle, shrieking with high-pitched glee, even as they're trodden on by the advancing, unbroken kill squads. Slack-bellied plague-bearers lurch out of the broom, swarming with bloatflies and dripping with butter-yellow bile. Other summoned horrors slide and jump in the broken light, creatures with bloody horned faces or stretched bestial limbs. A stench rolls ahead of them, one that catches in the throat and chokes with vomit. The cultists scream and go mad, running wildly from a mix of terror and elation. The noise is deafening, swollen by the engines and the war cries and the massed trample of armoured boots. For a moment, a gust of the world's storm wind briefly pulls the walls of flame and dirt aside, and a glimpse of the citadel flashes before them all, gaunt and ravaged and burned down to black. Faint lights shine along the parapets, and banners snap in the skirling tornado. The void shields are still in place, a ceiling of reactor-fed energy that resists the orbital barrage and sends it rolling in cataracts down the far cliff edges. There are walls within walls, towers ranked atop towers, all crammed with guns and defenders, and the stubborn pride of an Astartes Praeses chapter. An aquila can be seen, etched in royal blue on a white ground. Then it is gone, blotted out, just another burning mountain amid the murk. The guns roll, the tanks drag, the ranks of traitor space marines begin the long haul under scything lines of fire. They are hungry, they are famished, and the feast has only just begun.